This is Frank Prattle. You're listening to Zephyr Thrall at WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate at www.wps1.org. We're here today at the International Center for the Arts at San Francisco State University with two extremely special guests, Rigo 23, who is an artist and activist here in San Francisco. Hi, Rigo.
Hello.
And Richard Kamler, who is an artist, activist, curator as well. Hi.
Hi, Zephyr.
Maybe you guys can just start out by introducing yourselves, give a little bit of information about who you are and what it is that you do.
I'm Richard Kamler. I always have a moment of pause, like, you know, what do I actually do and where did it all start? There's a couple of moments in my life, which I think might happen to everybody, in terms of, you know, my practice, where it started. I went to school at Berkeley in the 60s, so with that in mind, you should be aware of the fact that I was involved with all the turmoil which was around Berkeley. So a lot of my attitudes were developed around that. And then when I left Berkeley, I went to apprentice myself, much like a Renaissance apprenticeship, in New York. And I apprenticed myself to an Austrian visionary, a man who was a painter, a sculptor, an architect, a man named Frederick Kiesler. And I lived with him for 3 years, and it was like going to get a PhD in art making. I did everything for him. And I realized that after a while, that if I could play God, I would require all of every young artist, every student, to sort of go to find an apprentice, somebody who you really respected and wanted to work with. So I did that. But the moment when I was coming up the stairs to his studio, left the door open for him, he was expecting me, and he was talking to another person. I overheard him, and he had said, "Through art, we can change the laws of the world." And I just come from Berkeley, you must realize, so I felt like I was coming home. Like, you know, we can change the laws of the world through art, and I thought, that's what I wanted to hear. And then the second moment, which was really important to me, is I think it was maybe the late 70s, early 80s, a friend of mine was working in San Quentin, and I went over there. She invited me over one night to show some slides of my work, so I did. And I was literally blown against the back wall of San Quentin. I don't quite know what happened to me. I was excited and interested and scared and titillated even. Decided I wanted to work there. So I got a job as an artist in residence. I got a grant from the California Arts Council as an artist in residence. And I worked there at San Quentin State Prison. And I worked there for 3 years. And that experience profoundly impacted the kind of art I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. And really, more importantly, what I still struggle with is the venue of where I would like the work to be. I mean, I'm in the art world, so the work gets shown in venues like here, like the gallery here. And I also am very interested in where I can put the work, what should have a greater impact. So I really struggle with that still. And then I eventually finished with the prison work, so I'll stop at the moment.
We'll get back to that in just a second. Rigo, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do.
I'm a human being. I live on a planet that a lot of people call Earth, some other people call Terra, some other people call names I cannot say. But I originally was born in Madeira Island, Portugal, and I've been in San Francisco or on Ohlone land since 1985, and I make art. I'm somewhat curious and rather disappointed by the states of affairs in our contemporary world, and end up often finding myself making art to deal with what is my place in the world. You know?
Sounds good. One of the things that really draws me to both of you as artists is, Richard, what you were talking about earlier is that you both exhibit on a large scale in non, you know, standard formats, you know, on places that people are not used to seeing art. You know, Rigo yourself, you know, painting on the sides of large buildings by the side of freeways, and Richard, you know, exhibiting outside of jails, you know, in large fields of grass and things like that. Maybe you guys can both, you know, share a little bit of why you felt the need to break outside of that kind of white cube gallery context.
Well, I have what I would describe as a healthy sort of relationship with my parents, you know, meeting that I like them and I like what they showed me of the world, you know. And my parents never really went many times into museums or galleries. I was born in a small island called Madeira Island. So I would like to think that if I did not know my parents, they would have a chance to experience my art. So I like to, as much as possible, make my art in a place where people can see it without having an habit of going to museums, of going to places so-called of high culture, or even not having the extra time to go outside of their daily routines, survival routines, to encounter art. So I try as much as possible to bring art into places that it might not be most expected, and the other way around, to bring places or situations into art that are not necessarily expected to be found in the art or something like that.
In addition, you were one of the co-founders of one of probably the greatest, I would say, outdoor art movements in San Francisco, that being known as Clarion Alley Mural Project, no? And you had an integral role in starting that project, no?
Right. Yeah. Well, there was a group of six of us that started the Clarion Alley Mural Project, and we were inspired by Balmy Alley, which was something that had been started in the Mission as well, the Mission District of San Francisco. But that had been started in the mid-80s. And it had been an effort that mostly celebrated or the survival of the cultures that were being intervened on militarily by the United States in Central America, you know. When we started Clarion Alley Mural Project, the idea was more to document sort of the North Mission. There was a hodgepodge of all kinds of people coming from all kinds of different places of the world with sort of all kinds of interests and quirks. So we kind of saw Clarion Alley Mural Project as an outgrowth of Balmy Alley and a continuation of the same impulse of taking over a street without purchasing any buildings, but by just sort of asking permission and dialoguing with tenants and landlords and try to create an open-air gallery or an open-air museum or an open-air venue for art.
Different platform. And Richard, yourself, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you weren't necessarily interested in the strict confines of the gallery.
The work which I do, which is outside of the gallery or museum context, is very specific in some senses. I mean, probably work best to give you an example. I was one time very interested in abolishing the death penalty. So I simply looked around the states and decided I had to do a piece in Huntsville, Texas around this issue. And Huntsville, Texas, for those of you that don't know, is the death penalty capital of this country. It's where more people are murdered by the state than any other.
Where in Texas is
Huntsville?
Huntsville. Where is it, though?
Oh, it's 65 miles north of Houston.
Okay.
And if you drive up there from Houston, what you see on the freeway is an 85-foot-tall cast concrete figure of Sam Houston. And I assumed when I first saw that I was in Texas because it was bigger than the trees. It's just this enormous, you know, cast concrete figure. But Huntsville itself has 8 state prisons and 1 state university. So I decided that I wanted to do a piece around the death penalty in Huntsville, Texas. So that's what I meant by the venue. And then I had done another piece. I used to be, when I left San Quentin, primarily because I became a prison abolitionist and I felt I couldn't participate, even with art, in being inside of a prison. So I went to work in the county jail in San Francisco, and there used to be a herd of bison living at the county jail. And it was very weird to me to drive in and out of the county jail a couple of nights a week, and I would see these bison living there. And, you know, a couple hundred years ago, they were kept there. They were penned up for their survival. And right next door, there was this huge Art Deco prison penned up for my survival. And I thought that was just weird. there's this gorgeous meadow right in front of the county jail, so I decided I'd build 100 bison. So that's what I did. I built 100 full-size bison out of plywood and strung them across the field and had a big audio tape. So I make a specific effort to put a piece which would essentially confront, in some ways, the dominant culture that we need to sort of pay attention. And I guess as I've gotten older, I don't have that same confrontational attitude, but I feel that for to really sort of make a point, you have to sort of, you know, almost grab people and shake them and say, pay attention here, you know, this can't go on. So those are just a couple examples.
And another example is actually playing in the background right now, which is known as The Sound of Lions Roaring, which is a piece that you have originally completed in the middle of the San Francisco Bay outside of San Quentin on a boat, if I'm not mistaken, and then are reproducing here, you know, some many years later. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that, and and Rigo, feel free to jump in as well.
I love this piece, I should say.
That's fine.
I really do. I really love it. So I'll wait for 1 second while we can hear the piece. But
yeah, hold on. Some silence.
It's a great piece. Anyway, okay. What had happened was you know, I also should say that this piece was designed for here to be run during the course of the show, and it only was allowed to play the opening of the show, which was February the 20th, I think, something like that, and then a second time on March 1st. And I know Riga will have something to say about a piece which he had done for the show as well. But anyway, so this particular piece was done in 1992. In 1976, Rose Byrd, who was the Chief Justice of California at that time, had abolished the death penalty. And then it was brought back. And they had the first execution in, let's see, that's about 16 years to take place in San Quentin. And so I decided that I wanted to surround San Quentin with the sound of lions roaring, which you can hear right now. And we sent out a press release saying, you know, that the sound of lions was to suggest the collective sense of rage and sorrow and anger at state-sanctioned murder. And so in collaboration with a group called the Peace Navy, Bob Heifetz and a bunch of other anarchist sailors, I had made an audio tape of the roar. I just went out to the zoo during the feeding time and recorded the lions feeding. So that's really what that is. And then we did put through a lot of tweaking and so forth, and went over there with two boats and huge concert grand speakers at about 7:30 at night, and hid out in some of the coves over there. And then the way the state does this kind of thing, they have at 12:00 midnight. 12:01 is when they execute. Because if they keep the person alive for 24 hours, a 30-day stay automatically kicks in. And the state doesn't want to do that. It's too expensive. So they want to kill them as quick as they can. So we hid out in the coves over there, and then at 12:01, it's, you know, pitch black at night, and we make a pass, and we crank up what you're hearing right now. And there was an enormous amount of people and international media in front of the East Gate at San Quentin, and all the lights come out towards the bay because it was inky black out there. And we made a second pass, then we hear the helicopters coming, you know, in about 10 minutes, and they pin the light down on us, you know, like, here's this light. And that was a little bit scary, even though it was going to happen. Then Coast Guard boards the boat, and a lot of stuff happened at that moment, and they took us under their jurisdiction and took us back. But what happened, why they were called, because the sound was so dramatic and so loud that the warden heard it inside of the prison. And he had called the Coast Guard, and we got arrested and so forth. But it didn't stop the execution, I should say, and they still continue. So I'm really glad this piece is out here to recall that. So that was the sound, that is the sound of lions roaring.
That's absolutely fascinating. And so the repercussions of that later were that you got a ticket, arrested?
No, we got arrested. The Coast Guard, I wish it was a ticket. We got arrested. The Coast Guard came and boarded our boat, and I mean, you know, this was a context for the time. So a lot of guys, people on the boat, then people were throwing stuff they shouldn't have over the side of the boat, you know, controlled substances over the side of the boat, you know, because we weren't supposed to have, you know. So that was stupid, I should say, because we could have gotten much more. But they arrested us, and the charge, as you can imagine, was, you know, trivial. The charge was a public nuisance and a sound ordinance. But they did want to sort of pursue it, so we did have to appear, and I think my recollection there was a $50 fine or something like that. Oh. You know, but you know, they still continue this. I mean, you know, I mean, Rigo knows the stories down in Angola, you know, and state-sanctioned murder is just something which is part of our community.
Well, and I think that's a perfect dovetail to talk about kind of the next question that I had for you guys is, as many people making art in the world today, definitely in Chelsea and you know, commercial art scenes across the globe, they could really give a damn about, you know, affecting any kind of change in the world. It's become a very lucrative market for selling contemporary art. And so what and why do you guys do the art you do? I mean, it's definitely motivated by something outside of, you know, your common factor of greed that seems to pervade all over the place. So why?
I make the art that I make because I can't help it, you know. I'm not alone in that, you know. There's many people that set out to talk about beauty and end up talking about injustice or oppression. So, for instance, today, just on my walk here through campus, I saw four uniformed policemen, you know. The other day I was coming here and there was a delivery man, Latino, Latin American immigrant most likely, who was pulled, apparently when he came into university to deliver some goods, he hit one of several police cars, you know, that were
Whoops.
Parked literally in his way. So I'm coming into campus and there's like this worker, you know, a driver that's being accosted by four police cars worth of policemen because he bumped into a police car. And obviously the police cars should not have been there, you know. There's so many police cars you cannot even probably deliver milk to the university without running into one. And I mean, the Clarinale that you mentioned before is in front of a police station, and I think it would make so much more sense if in every police station there was lots of university students. You know, men and women, university students walking through the police station at any time they fucking feel like it, you know? Because it is, you know, I think I don't understand why in American campus there has to be such a huge police presence, you know?
Well, many people would argue that, you know, given the recent shootings and violence on, you know, college campuses, high school campuses, things like that, that many people actually request police officers to be here. What do you guys think about that?
Well, they are the ones who have weapons and guns and capacity to inflict violence, right? I mean, is there a correlation in the campus that have more policemen with the campus where there are less shootings, you know?
I don't know.
Right.
You know, I think that I make art for a range of reasons. One, because it's really fun. It really is fun. I mean, and there's not really much else I can do. You know, I kind of, you know what I mean? I was, you know, when I was like younger, I was the class drawer. You know, I could draw good. I could draw well. So people would give me their tasks to do. So it's really fun, and as I've gotten older and began to think about it more, I began to sort of realize that it, for me, it's really transformative. I mean, it changes me every time I'm doing a piece, you know. I'm getting engaged with different people and different communities, and it's really exciting and fun, and, you know, and things happen, which I can't imagine, and that's what I love. I can't quite imagine what's going to happen. And, oh yeah, I didn't think about that, you know, or I never thought you could do that or say that. And, you know, it's kind of like the imagination. It really is. It changes people, saves lives, actually. actually saves lives. I mean, it's an opportunity. You know, if we think of like the shootings, the horror shootings on campus, the stage after that is the opportunity to get creative, not to sort of impose greater and greater and greater force. You know, so we have a police state, which we're close to in many times, but it's an opportunity to sort of, you know, how do we be creative about this? How do we do something? How do we make art out of that insanity? That's what excites me.
What was a sticker, Zephyr, just now I remembered, a sticker that I put in New York, actually, when I was passing through there, that said, the fathers kill in faraway countries, the kids do it at school. The end of the American century. It was late 20th century, so that's...
Now, Richard, one of the questions that, and Rigo, this applies directly to what you just said, one of the questions that you tend to ask people, and just for the listening audience, Richard happens to have a radio show where he does things similar to this and talks to people on the air, which is damn good. You should listen to it. You can get it at richardkamler.org, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that you tend to ask people, and that, you know, I'm quite fond of as well, is, you know, do artists have a social responsibility to the community in which they live? And it appears that, you know, you guys have some fairly strong feelings on that. Maybe you can speak about it.
Well, I certainly have strong feelings about that. I feel that, for me, you know, we are part of a community, and that means there's rights and responsibilities. You know, in traditional cultures, our role was called that of the shaman. And, you know, we were responsible for the decorative life of the community and all the ceremonies and the rituals. And in the contemporary life, you know, that I want to be part of a community. And so I feel I have a social responsibility, and the community has a responsibility to me as well. And my responsibility, if I put something out there, like if I put lions out there, or I put any kind of, you know, a guerrilla action out there, you know, a non-permanent action out there, I have to take the responsibility for that. And I'm happy to do it. You know, and so I feel that I mean, it's like I teach up at USF, and it's a complex concept, but I think, you know, that a lot of it's really about temperament. And I want to be part of a community, you know, and if someone wants to sort of, you know, engage in studio work and do studio work, that's fine with me. I do think they still have a social responsibility to put the work out there, that they have to take responsibility for what the work is saying. I mean, a classic example is Leon Golub, the New York painter, whose work is enormously provocative, and he takes enormous responsibility for what his work says, and he's had a lot of controversy about his work. So I think that aspect of social responsibility is important. There's one other question which I sometimes use on my show, which is related to a current project I'm working on called Seeing Peace, P-E-A-C-E. And that question is what I think we were just suggesting earlier about the notion of an opportunity. And the question is, what would have happened if Picasso had painted the Guernica before the bombs fell on Guernica? And that's really suggesting that the artists are proactive, that everybody knows the horrors of police states. You know the horrors of bombs falling down, you know, and people jumping out of 911. Okay, so what does the future look like? You know, what if you're proactive?
Many people would argue, and maybe Rigo, you can address this, that America is simply too apathetic to give a shit, basically, that the people are getting fatter. Television is occupying more and more mental space. You know, I think the average estimate now is 4 hours a day for the adult of television watching. And in that, screw it. That, you know, why bother with social activism when you have everything that you need inside your living room, and that there is no change in that? What's your response to that?
Well, responding to your first question, I think the notion of social responsibility is one that an individual has to feel. You know, it comes from within. I think education is very important, you know. But I think that an artist having social responsibility in their work is great, but it would be much better if generals and congressmen had social responsibility in their work. That definitely could affect way more change than artists. You know, as far as I think the United States of North America, has sort of been a bit of a social experiment for a while, right? Since the arrival of Europeans here. And so I think that some things that are specific to the USA soon after are no longer, and, you know, become also problems in other societies. I think that it's mostly an issue of comfort. You know, like the inmates that were kept in Alcatraz, they were the best fed out of the federal system because the waters were very cold, or are very cold, in the San Francisco Bay. So their jails, the temperature was actually heated, and they were given a lot of food so that they'd be enough out of shape that they could not swim out of Alcatraz. And I really think that there's just a concentration of wealth, you know, in this country that leads to a lot of what you're calling apathy. Is like, you know, if you feel that a situation is unjust, but you are clearly on the receiving end of that injustice, it takes a little bit more discipline to want to stop that injustice than if you are in the end of the people who are being victimized or wronged by the injustice. I think that the corporate media and the quality of programming on television, which, you know, I don't watch and stuff like that, but yeah, I think it's very poor. I think I've been in the United States for about 20 years, and every time there is an election, I always hear a politician talking about cutting money for education. So I'm actually amazed that there still exists a budget for education, you know? So every single time there is an election, they talk about cutting money for education, you know.
In fact, San Francisco State University, where we're currently located right now, is having huge budget difficulties. And I was listening to a speech outdoors maybe an hour ago where a teacher was saying that perhaps one-third of the classes will be cut here at San Francisco State by next year if budget cuts go through. So I'm definitely a pertinent topic. Now, to talk about a controversial issue that both of you... weigh in on is the death penalty. And many people, when considering the death penalty and considering political action around that, the first question that jumps into their mind is, you know, once again, like, why do you care? Did you have somebody who died? Was it, you know, did your father or your brother, you know, sister die in the electric chair or something? Why, what makes you care about capital punishment?
Well,
those without capital get the punishment. That's Mumia Abu Jamal.
Period there, yeah. And exclamation point. Yeah. Well, for me, it just started what I'd mentioned earlier when I was in the Austin residence in San Quentin. And so I got friendly with a lot of the men on both the general population and on death row. And over time, I became friends with a couple of the guys on death row, and it just got personal. They're friends, and once I was walking out with one of this friend's mother, and she was telling me this story, which I've mentioned sometimes before, that she was talking about when he was born, and she was talking about 37 years ago when he was born, and she was in a hospital waiting room, waiting for her son to be born. And, you know, for any of you which have children, who have children, you know, it's a time of great hope and great celebration. All these opportunities for the future are unlimited. You know, child's being born. Her husband was in another waiting room, you know, with cigars and champagne. And then she fast forward 37 years to the future, and she was in another waiting room, waiting for the state to kill her son. So I, at that moment, decided I would build a waiting room that isn't the way for a, quote, unquote, and I use this very advisedly, for a civilized society to behave. You don't kill. The state should not be in the business. I know they are. But they should not be in the business of killing its citizens. That's not the business of its state. The state is in the business of educating them, you know, providing health care for them, decent housing. And so here's the other extreme, you know, of what I think of as state-sanctioned murder. And the reality is that if you abolished prisons, you know, you would have 80% of the people, 88% of people on the street, and everybody has their poster child, you know, who is the serial rapist or, you know, the horror story, and that's maybe 15% who need to be kept in a safe, and secure and sane environment. So I just feel that I don't want to really, actually, I just don't want to live in a society which kills its citizens. I really don't.
What? Just to quickly interject, though, are you suggesting that it would be a good idea to abolish prisons and just let the people out on the street?
I'm not suggesting it. I firmly believe it.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that as we, you know, as creative people have a responsibility to sort of, you know, ask ourselves, what would it look like? What would a society actually look like? What would it smell like? You know, what would be the color of it, the texture of it, if you will? Of a society that did not have prisons. How would we deal with people that broke the social contract? What would we do? I mean, people have to be held accountable. But, I mean, I don't want some of these people to get out of prison living next to me, man. They are really angry. You know, I'm not joking, they're really angry, and I don't want them next door to me with that. Furious. And I would be furious as well. So I think if we tear them down and figure out a different way to do it. And we can. That's what I feel.
I think, when we talk about environmental problems, and, you know, there's always sort of a very quaint or a very easy first step, or which is recycling, you know. If you keep drinking Coca-Cola, but if you just keep the can and recycle it, you're already helping the environment, you know. And this, of course, is a very naive and sort of childish approach to the problems of overconsumption and environmental destruction, but it does in fact help a little, right? And I understand that a soda can has some value, and so does an old newspaper or, you know, a Tetra Pak. But I have a hard time thinking that a human being is worth less than a soda can, you know? So if we can recycle a soda can, we should definitely at least try to recycle a human being, you know? What? We all make mistakes, and being that the death penalty or, you know, put them in a cell, lock the door and throw away the key is the equivalent of, like, you know, open the car window as you're frying down Route 66 with the wind in your hair and toss that bottle out the car because, you know, you want to drink enough things, and if you kept the vessels in the car, it wouldn't be comfortable anymore.
Well, I think many people would agree with you that, you know, human beings are definitely worth more than a soda can, you know, that the vast majority of prison convicts can be rehabilitated and, you know, brought back into society. But many people feel that there's a certain portion or, you know, of people that that have really crossed the boundary, that that are rehabilitative. Is that even a word? Who knows?
Yeah, some people cross the boundaries, but then there's a whole huge number of people where the boundaries cross them. Like, for instance, if you talk about societal groups in the United States, the one societal group that is by most apparently in larger numbers in prison are the descendants of people that their own bodies wasn't even their own property. You know, people who were sold, you know, I think you call that slave trade or something, you know, and so the descendants of the slaves are now again enslaved, because when the 13th Amendment was passed, it was with the caveat that except for the convicted felon, no?
Right.
So in the United States right now, there's 2.3 million legal slaves, and out of all the social groups
more
who are legally, you know, deserving of being treated as a slave, most of them are descendants of the ones who were slaves, you know. So, you know, you have to see what people cross the borders and then which people the borders cross them, you know. There's no moment in my life in San Francisco that I feel more at risk than when I'm close to a policeman. That's hands down. And I live in the Mission District that's full of junkies and, you know, yuppies, alcohol,
both of them pissing on the sidewalk,
and, you know,
yeah,
and all this stuff. But I never feel like that there is a situation where I cannot talk or maybe, you know, engage in a discussion than with a uniformed dude with a lot of guns, you know.
Well, maybe you can talk. Go for it.
I don't really do any prison work any longer. I mean, politically, I'm still involved with it, but in terms of my art, I really don't. But when I finished it, what made me finish it, I realized that I'd never worked with victims, with people who had been impacted by perpetrators. And so I decided that I needed to do some work around that. And so I spent 2 years going to meetings of parents of murdered children. I really began to sort of understand that to really do, at least for me anyway, to really sort of work in an area which is really as deep as I can go around issues of social practice, I had to include the victims. And that was, for me, enormously traumatic. You know, people that have had their... for me, it seems the worst thing imaginable. You know, someone murdered mice, and I would just go kill the person. I wouldn't think twice. You know what I'm saying?
You heard it here first.
I mean, that's the feeling you have. And so these people, you know, it's against the law. I mean, I know it's against the law to kill people, but it's against the law of nature. That, you know, the old people go first, and then the kids go next, and it works that way, you know? But here it's been turned around. And so I decided I wanted to do a piece around parents of murdered children and the perpetrators. So I have a real strong feeling about shows like this and conferences like this, and I had mentioned it, I should say, to the people that... we're putting these things together, that you need to include victims' voices. And there weren't any. I came to this Saturday's event, and it was really powerful and a moving event, but there were no victims' voices heard. And so without that, we will keep building more prisons, and we will keep executing people. There needs to be they need to be part of the equation. You know, you have the institution, you have the community, or you have the perpetrators, you have to have the victims brought into it. And if not, then... You know, you won't be in school because they'll be building more prisons, and that's where the money will go. I mean, I once was going to do a piece where I suggest an exchange program with Harvard University and San Quentin State Prison, because at that time, at that time, the admission to Harvard was the same as what it cost to put an inmate in San Quentin for 1 year. And so I wrote a letter to the director of admissions there, suggesting if you wanted to send someone to San Quentin for a year, we could sort of provide an inmate to Harvard for 1 year.
And? Yeah.
Well, I never heard back from him.
Was San Quentin into it?
Yeah.
They were like, yes!
Sure. They would have someone go to Harvard. Anyway. Sorry, I got a little...
Speaking of prisons, though, Rigo, one of your pieces here at the Fine Arts Gallery was dealt directly with prisons. It was a huge sign, a one-way sign, that in the middle of it said prison. And you guys had hung it outside the gallery and on a large, I would say maybe 5-story building that stretched down a few stories and pointed directly up towards the sky. And recently there were some complications with that, though. What happened?
Yeah, well, something, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know. And there are certain issues that are purposefully sort of kept out of people's minds, you know, like there's a reason why the news coverage don't show images of dead Iraqis or dead, you know, Palestinians that much, because it's not a pretty sight to see somebody with their innards spread out and their face smushed like a tomato. It's just not fun. So people don't get to see those images very much. They see, you know, some pop singer or something. So my idea was to make visible prisons, because they are not very present in people's psyche, even though I'm told here at San Francisco State University there is more people studying to be prison guards than to be high school teachers. So I wanted to put an arrow on the side of the building that just said prisons, and I was told that the president of the university felt very strongly that he could not have an arrow pointing at the university and calling it a prison. And I was like, well, it doesn't have to point down. It can point anywhere, you know. It's a vertical building, so, you know, doesn't, you know, horizontally won't fit, you know. So then they said it was a security issue, a liability issue, to have this piece of cloth hanging in the same spot where a rather large American flag once hung. So 2 weeks after the show opened, they finally said, okay, you can do it, you know? So the arrow sort of giddily pointed towards the heavens with the word prisons. Well, today is March 5th. The show is supposed to go on for another 11 days. And I was told it's a particularly beautiful day out here. You know, it's really sunny.
And mind you, it's been gorgeous for about the last week.
Right. So I was told that the university took down the banner because it was going to start to rain. And in the rain, it was definitely going to be an issue. So I don't know, man. I just really, it's so disappointing, you know? It's like,
I mean, so obviously you suspect other motives than simply preserving your artwork?
Right. I suspect they really don't, you know, they don't want the students to be thinking about issues that might, I don't know, vibe with what they're feeling, or that might somehow encourage them to talk about things which are unpleasant, or, you know, which don't help uphold the status quo, you know.
Such as lions roaring.
Such as the sounds of lions, you know.
Well, let's see if anybody has any questions on the audience. We're surrounded right now by a good probably 30 or 40 people. Anybody have any questions for these gentlemen? If you could come here for just a second.
Looking at the Stanley Tuffy Williams exhibit, on the right side, there's a whole listing of the modern slave trades. Just like to ask both of you, gentlemen, you two, about, do you feel there's an artist responsibility to get deep into that, especially in this country, to educate, be an educator, when this is not being taught in general in the schools from kindergarten on up? And you have to come to a school like San Francisco State and take a black child development course in order to find out about it at a much later age. So I'd like you to address that.
I think there's a reason why a society that has more wealth concentrated in the top 1% than in the bottom 90% would want to reserve high-end education to the elite. So what I found amazing in the United States is there are fantastic universities here. I mean, I studied at San Francisco Art Institute. I was blown away that I could have a teacher that was 20-some years old or 30 years old, you know. In many societies, you only get the right to sort of teach when you're an elder, you know. So it makes for a very kind of dynamics. And then I got to work at a public high school. And man, I felt like crying every day, you know. These kids are being completely defrauded. They're not being given an education, you know. Around lunchtime, there's a police car going around the school, you know. The person that wrote my check as an artist in residence was this young Chinese-American girl that she was helping with administration. The kids are picking up soda cans to meet the ends of the school. It's completely appalling, you know. That a society that has $500 billion to spend in weapons doesn't see it as its responsibility to teach its children, you know? It's crazy. So what I think that the strategy is, okay, educate a few extremely well and keep the vast majority, you know, as unpolished of a diamond as possible so we can treat them like rocks. You know, what is happening now is that other countries, luckily, are starting to be able to educate very well higher numbers of people than the United States. So I think the United States used to compete in education, in economy, and more it's only competing militarily through brutal force. And when you go more and more in the direction of like wanting to convince your lover or your adversaries through beating them up, it's going to make for a kind of a crazy place. You're going to have the rich people living in neighborhoods which are, what are they called, gated. You're going to have the bad guys living in another neighborhood which are gated, you know. And, you know, you're keeping the social classes, each one behind their gate, and everybody cleaning dishes, speaking Spanish.
Richard, yourself?
You know, I think that if you look at who owns the universities and the colleges, and you look at the board of directors, you look at the board of regents, and then it's clear the policies which universities have to follow. I mean, they are really plantations. I mean, take a look at the Board of Regents of the University of California or the Board of Regents of the State College Universities and see who these people are. They're not me or Rigo or your instructors in this place. These are people that are in the 1% elite. I mean, their income is larger than probably 50 or 60% of the countries in the United Nations, okay? So it doesn't surprise me. What angers me is that we know this, and we should, and I use that word again, you know, we should do something about this. That these people sit on the Board of Regents will say, well, we have to build a new building. Well, you don't need a new building to educate someone. You can educate them under a tree. Isn't that what Plato did? He brought people that wanted to learn to people that wanted to teach. He brought them under the tree. I mean, it's nice to have a gallery to put your paintings up on the wall, you know? But in terms of responding to your comment, I mean, I mean, there was a show, an interesting show done several years ago in New York at the Guggenheim, a German artist, Hans Hacke. And he simply took a set of photographs of all the members of the board of directors of the Guggenheim Museum, okay? You can imagine who they were. They were the head of J.P. Morgan, the head of, you know, New York Mutual, you know, port authorities. Thomas Messer, who was the director at that time, took the work down. All it was photographs with their job descriptions below it. That was it. That was it. There wasn't any, you know, in-your-face kind of art. No. It was a photograph like, you know, like you're going to a country. Photograph, dear mom, had a nice time. This is just the person's job description. So the enormous power which they have, but it's our social responsibility as artists, chemists, whatever it is, sort of, you know, make this visible. And I think, you know, that's what we need to do, because this goes on and on and on unless we tear it apart.
Well, unfortunately, I believe that's about all the time we have. But my name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is WPS1, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You're listening at www.wps1.org. Or you might also be listening to frankprattle.com. Today, my special guests, Fiery, on in the belly of the beast, Roland, is Richard Kamler, who is an artist, activist, educator, and curator here in San Francisco. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you, Frank.
And Rigo 23, who is an artist and activist here in San Francisco as well. Thank you.
Thank you.